This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 7, Episode 9, The Gear Barrier. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we talk about the use of gear and whether it's a barrier to better coaching and better playing. We also help players with playing Yorkers and an under-19 state cricketer who doesn't know whether to attack or defend the very first ball he faces. Can we advise him in that much detail? Listen in to find out on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This, of course, is your guide to better cricket. It doesn't matter who you are or where you are, we're here to help you. Three coaches who are going to do their best in the next half an hour or so. Who are we? Well, my name is David Hinchliffe. I look after things here. And joining me on the line from Millfield School, it's the Director of Cricket Coaching there, Mark Garraway. How are you, Garrus?
I'm very good. It's another lovely day that you catch me on. A bit blowy, but it's a good day. Been doing some diving catching today, and the mowers have done their job. The square looks absolutely amazing.
Brilliant. Well, last night we were outside and we were pumping up incrediballs into a swirling wind, and everyone was running around not being able to see where the ball was going.
Brilliant.
But they were catching most of them, so they were well into it. So we were very excited here as well about the wind and the outdoors being accessible again. Secondly, on the line, it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers. Are you blinking into the sunlight yet?
Well, we have got plenty of sunshine. We've not been out this week, but we're going to try and get it on Friday. The fields are all kind of underway in their transformation from a rugby venue into a cricket venue, and it's already started. So pitches have had a bit of rolling, which is good to see. Crazy Bob's been out with the mower, so it looks all right.
Crazy Bob. He sounds like quite the character. Speaking of characters, we had a fantastic question this week on the Pitch Vision Academy Facebook page. I thought we could just cover this off right in the introduction. It's a pretty good one. It's from our very good friend, Ahan. And Ahan says, please can you give me ideas on how I can improve my short selection? So I'm going to say no Bermudas. Anyone improve on that?
Yeah, well, I'd say pockets are key for me.
Good one. Good one.
Yeah, love a pocket. That's good. And just really the ability to be able to move multi-directional without splitting the back of them, I think, is always a good thing.
Yeah, you need a bit of give there, don't you?
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, okay, fantastic. Well done. That's great. I hope that helps you, Ahan. And moving on to an article that I saw recently, which was quite an interesting thought experiment, I suppose, more than anything else. And it was about the gear barrier, and I'll put a link to the show notes in it. And it was a rugby-related article, but the general principle behind it was worth thinking about whether we can apply it to cricket as well. And the question was really revolving around, does equipment form a barrier between the coach and the player? In rugby, there's an argument that it does. So if it does form a barrier, is there an argument to say, can you spend time doing work with very little equipment deliberately on purpose to try and build a relationship between the coach and the player?
I don't necessarily think that the gear does. I suppose the only one really that I'd say that may be true would be the old-fashioned bowling machines, where often you can be in a small space with a whirring bowling machine and the coach feeding the ball in, and it's not always easy to hear, and that communication barrier can exist potentially. But nowadays, with bowling machines that are remote control, that you can, you've got automatic feeders in and various other things like that, we can even get close to players one there when they're doing their stuff against bowling machines. So I don't think it's quite the same from a cricket point of view as it may be for rugby. And often I think that the bits of equipment that we've got in cricket are there to make players more self-reliant, less reliant on the coach rather than anything else. An example of that will be, you know, your catch it boards, your crazy catches, your throwing nets, all of that sort of stuff can actually be done away from a net environment, away from one-to-ones, where you give people the opportunity to be self-reliant. So in that way, I think whilst they're not with the coach, I also think it's really healthy for them to be practicing skills using that type of equipment on their own. So I'd say the only bit of kit that I've ever had communication breakdown over was sort of the old-fashioned bowling machine where you can get a bit distant and it, you know, your communication can sometimes be impeded.
Lavis, I know you're a little bit of a kit junkie. How do you think you would cope with if you turned up one day and the kit cupboard was locked and all you had was a couple of cricket balls and a bat?
Yeah, I think it would work really well, but I think it has to be taken in the right kind of with the right view on how it's going to be implemented. And often with these ideas, people suggest, how about you do something and you do it all the time? And the article actually suggests you try it for a year. And that's actually not the best way to take these kind of ideas. It's often introducing small little chunks. And if you have the odd session where you don't use any sort of fancy equipment, then that's absolutely fine. And it makes people think a little bit more, potentially a bit more creatively about the drill they're going to put into place and how they really kind of design the session they're going to have. But the equipment's there to help us, and a lot of the time it will do so. We do have lots of great ideas that come up in kind of coaching discussions like this, and it's finding the right balance between utilizing equipment that you've got and also in rugby in this instance, which it was referring to, is trying to go back to the kind of bare bones and of gameplay of 15 on 15 or 7 on 7 or whatever it might be. So it needs to be taken in small chunks and used appropriately, really.
Yeah, so there are times when using lots of equipment is suitable to the situation. There are times where you feel like, you know, you do want to get down and dirty and just do that, do it as simple as possible. You know, if you need to use a tennis ball and do drop feeds or underarm feeds, and you've got a guy with a bat and that's all you need to achieve what you want to achieve, then great. But yeah, you don't need to artificially restrict yourself either way, do you really? I mean, it can be, there can be times when using lots of equipment is exactly the right thing to do. And if you do lose any communication as part of that, then as long as your overall plan means that you are communicating well, then that's all that matters in the end of the day.
Absolutely. Just as a side note, what's the most number of cones you've seen on a pitch at one time?
Andy Hurry's got the record for me. So the ex-Somerset coach, who's now the England 19s coach. It'd have been three figures, I should imagine. Yeah, they were everywhere.
That's good.
I always used to take great delight in just picking the odd one up because that would completely scupper him.
Swapping around the green with the red.
Absolutely. I'll just pick one up. One that looks sort of like central to something, but not absolutely the main one. Take that away and see how he copes.
That's pretty good going, that.
Any advance on 100, Dave?
Oh, no, no. I mean, we do, at my club, we do use cones for a boundary when we're when we're bringing them in. But
that's fair enough.
There's probably 40 or 50 there, but other than that, it's nothing close to that. Probably 10 is probably my highest I've seen.
You need a team to collect them back in it before the game starts, don't you, really?
Yeah, it's part of the drill.
Well,
probably,
they have
isn't
that
it?
Don't they have it in American sports where they have cone interns who go around picking up the cones to make sure that nobody else has to do it.
Is that a step up or a step down from the water boy?
I don't know. I think that's career progression. Wow.
You do become very good at getting if you don't think about it, and you gradually get a bit of equipment out as you go along, and then you get to the end of the session and you realise you've got 12 different bits of kit that you've got to carry back in. You do get quite creative at how you get all that stuff back in one trip.
I've got a much better solution. It's right, everybody.
Yeah,
that works much better for me.
I think my favourite one of those is we were having a under-15s game last year, and I put out all the stuff to warm up. It was a nice evening, so I put out all the stuff to warm up about half an hour before the players started to arrive. And about 5 minutes before the players arrive, it absolutely threw it down for about 45 minutes.
Yeah, you do choose to live in Scotland, though, don't you? So that does tend to happen up there.
Yeah, that was. I was just sat in the pavilion watching the kit just get more increasingly covered.
Watching your Grey Nichols cloud catcher getting expanding by the second.
Expanding, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, luckily most of it's plastic. Yeah, you don't want the stuff that can absorb water. That's and you're in big trouble. Right, let's move on to the yes no round. That's three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more the team want to say. I've got the questions here, so let's fire away. You could stand at slip for 300 balls and only have one chance.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question. Club teams who rely on superstar imports are failing their local members.
Yes.
Yes.
Third question. The less training time you have, the more specific your focus should be.
Yes.
Yes.
Now it's time for the questions portion of the show. Here we do our very best to answer questions that have been sent in directly. Of course, we've already answered one, but we're going to go into a little bit more detail with the next couple of questions. You can send your questions in to us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com, and if you do that and your question gets read out and answered, you get the chance to win the prize of an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision at pitchvision.com. And that's what Rishav has done. So Rishav has sent in a short question, but one that I get asked now and again. It's, please give me suggestions on how to play Yorkers. I usually miss them and get bowled.
Well, the two things really. I suppose let's try and work out what type of Yorkie you're getting, I suppose. And when I say that, and what from what type of bowler? Because obviously, over the last few years, we've seen bowlers such as Malinga, and watching a game the other day in T20 cricket, seeing of the Indian lad who's very good at jamming Yorkers up into a block hole. I mean, for those guys, they're actually in some ways easier to face and not be bowled by a Yorker because you know that you're going to be getting them. I always used to find the most difficult bowlers to face a Yorker from were the ones that, chuck one in every blue moon, or it didn't actually appear to be part of their plan. It would come out maybe even as a bit of natural variation and cause you problems. So, you know, there's different contexts, I suppose, that you're facing a Yorker within. But you can practice this stuff, and a Yorker, particularly in 2020 cricket and shorter format cricket, is attempted more often than longer format. So if you're heading into that phase of a game, then it would seem pretty sensible that you do some work on it, both in order to get bat on it to preserve your wicket. But remembering back to my time with England and people like O.A. Shah coming in and practicing trying to score off Yorkers, and obviously you have a number of different strategies that you can deploy in order to be able to get good at digging out that Yorker, or to use that the length of the Yorker to be able to score. And he used to step back in his crease and in practice hitting that ball that was bounced on the crease line as far as he possibly can. He also used to stay as he was and try and get some form of bat on it and maybe try and turn it. He actually made an attempt to try and practice the ball that you could inside edge or inside half of the bat between your legs, inside of fine leg for four as well. So he came up with some quite innovative ways of trying to do that, getting away from the Yorker length and being able to beat maybe third man being up in the circle. So it's about being specific. But yeah, the most difficult Yorkers for me to face were always from a bowler that you didn't expect to bowl it. And it might, you know, just to come along. And I think that's a difficult thing to practice for. But certainly when you're going into matches and you're facing guys that you know have got a Yorker in them, then it would be sensible to do some practice around it. Duncan Fletcher used to talk about lowering your bat swing, maybe offering your stump so you're allowing your bat to come down in an unimpeded path, so it's not having to come around the body. And certainly when Waqar Yunus was in his pomp and Wasim Akram, that was certainly part of the preparation that England used to go into, would be batting maybe on leg stump and go with lower back swings, conceding maybe on the bounce if it goes upstairs on you and getting under that and just looking to try and defend your wicket and dig that ball out, particularly in a test match context when it started a reverse swing. So, you know, there have been a lot of players that have practiced it and gone pretty well at it. So if it's something that you've identified, then do some work on it.
And it is it's pretty simple technically, isn't it, Lavers? I mean, if you're looking to stop the ball hitting the stumps and that's that, then jam that back down as quickly as you can to stop the ball from going underneath it, right?
Yeah, it's getting down as quick as you can, and as was alluded to there, if you can ensure that the path of the bat is free to come down pretty straight in line with the stumps, then you've got a reasonably good chance. Stopping it though, if you're coming down from kind of second slip or wider and stopping it in exactly the right position, does become a bit tricky. Obviously, it's difficult to tell what a ball's going to do in terms of the line until it really arrives. And when it's that full, there is that opportunity for it to swing and potentially swing late. So the more you can make sure you're presenting a full face and coming down fairly straight, the better your chances of keeping that ball out are going to be.
Yeah. Is that the main cause of the problem when you see people miss it going under the bat? Or do you see people getting into a bad position and it going beating the outside or the inside?
The other thing I've seen a little bit of, which probably works hand in hand with where they position themselves, is sometimes people really trying very hard to get their feet out, their front foot out of the way.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you just get your front foot out of the way and leave your back foot where it is, you're going to open your body up and then you're going to cause that same issue again of opening up and coming across the line. So if you set up in the first place with a little bit more space, then you can be better prepared to stay in a reasonably side-on position where the bat's going to come down fairly straight without having to move your feet out of the way and then potentially getting yourself in a tangle, which could cause the bat to come down on a kind of path which isn't ideal and isn't going to give a full face of the bat. As Gareth said before, though, if you get someone who's consistently bowling it, then you can take the challenge back to them and you can move out of your crease, move deep in your crease. You can even change your position. I mean, if you wanted to, depending on what they're doing with their field, you can give yourself room, as was mentioned there, or you could even get across the stumps if they've gone fine leg in the ring, but they're probably going to have fine leg back with if they're bowling that. The thing I'd be thinking about is if you go back, you're potentially making the ball a bit flatter, and a flatter bowler bowls a better Yorker invariably. So the Malingas who bowl from quite a low position, the ball is a Yorker for longer, if that makes sense. So going into the 6 inches before it bounces and the 6 inches after it bounces are both going to be lower, so they're going to have a higher success rate of hitting that Yorker. So if you can make the bounce steeper, which would be coming out of your crease to face the Yorker instead and setting up a foot outside, you're going to increase the trajectory of the ball into the ground and the ball's going to be a Yorker for less duration. So that's the way I'd go, but if someone's consistent, I'd be doing that in conjunction with going deep as well. So I'll be mixing it up definitely and trying to put them off their length, and hopefully you'd be able to find a way of them creating a full toss or a half volley for you.
We have an interesting case of a 14-year-old lad who's playing for us at the moment, who has grown significantly recently. He's well over 6 feet tall now, and he keeps getting yorked by spinners. He keeps coming down the pitch, and then arriving just a fraction of a second incorrectly, and the ball goes under the bat, and he gets bowled by it. And my current working theory is that he hasn't worked out his stride length properly yet. He's got so much longer in recent times that he's getting there earlier than he previously had, and he keeps getting yorked. But anyway, we're working on that. But it's interesting to see someone, you know, consistently getting yorked by spinners in the same way every time.
And that could be two things, can't it? I think you've nailed it there. His stride length's probably changed. It sounds like it's changed significantly. And as a result, he's doing the same movement pattern as he was in his previous body height. Yeah. And he's going beyond the ball, isn't he? I mean, that's pretty much it. So again, if he's being consistent in it, it's a fantastic start for him to make that adaptation and probably look at that first stride as much as anything else and trying to reduce that a little bit. Because actually, if he's getting down with two long strides from that height, then there's a good chance that the ball that he's trying to hit back over the bowler's head should be a back foot shot anyway. So, you know, that's another way of opening up his mind a little bit, I suppose. And the other thing is that sometimes it can be really good bowling, can't it, that makes you go for a Yorker. So I remember playing against Robert Croft, for example, and he was somebody who you'd come down the wicket thinking you've got it, and then all of a sudden, you know, get it on the full toss, and all of a sudden it would dip. And I remember him having a couple of stumpings missed in games that I've played and I've watched on television, where the ball's gone under the bat because both the batter and the keeper thought it was going to be a full toss when he let go of it. And sometimes it can be good bowling as well. So, you know, whilst we don't want to give the bowlers too much credit, and we can work on the things that we can control, occasionally, particularly with spin, they can do some big, pretty good stuff to make the ball dip.
Oh yeah, and that's a powerful tool. Okay, next question is from Manish. And Manish says, hello, I'm an under-19 state cricketer, and I am in a little bit of confusion about how to play the first ball that comes to me. Should it be defensive or aggressive? Normally, I play aggressive with the first ball that comes to me. Can you give me some suggestions? So he hasn't really presented a problem as such. It's more of a philosophy, which all boils down to one ball, that first ball that he faces. So how can we unpick that one?
Well, I'd say, as with anything, we're looking to take opportunities, and our intention should invariably be to attack if we can. And obviously, we've got lots of different formats that could be in play, and he could be thinking about playing in a game that's over a series of days, or it could be a 20-20 or anything in between. But I'd like to think that most of the players that I work with will try and encourage a philosophy that if there's an opportunity to score, we're taking it. So we're looking to attack initially, and then if there's not an opportunity to attack, or the ball isn't in a location, or it hasn't reacted in a way that we expected or we predicted, then we're going to go more back towards that defensive mindset, or manipulating something slightly different that isn't our initial intention of hitting a four in a certain location. So I'd be thinking, if we can, try and attack.
I mean, from my perspective, one of the best bits of research that's been done over the course of the past 15 years in terms of batting was done by Greg Chappell and his assistant Ian Frazier on the intention to score, which was consistent across the top 100 test players of all time. So even in the longest format of a game, they felt that they were at their best when they always had an intention to score first, and then had the capacity to go down the intention, the aggressive intention stakes, I suppose, depending on the ball, the conditions and the bowler. So every ball they were starting with that intention to score, and then work their way down. So I think, you know, you're in the right state. I would probably change your terminology from aggressive to intent. So having an intent to score, because sometimes it's difficult to go from aggressive to passive. And we see that a lot in rugby and in football and in contact sport. We see that people find it very difficult to go from maybe in rugby, you know, to counter-rucking to then not counter-rucking. And they find that a tricky transition to make, because it's generally at two extremes of the continuum. And similarly, when we go aggressive, it's got quite a strong view. If you think about being aggressive in your head, then that's quite a long way away from being able to be defensive. So my view is always to think about having an intention to score, because I think it's easier for us mentally to flex ourselves appropriately according to the ball stimulus, to be the conditions or even the match stimulus that we are faced with. So that would be the general approach that the best players in the world, and I think it was something like 96 of the best 100 players statistically in Test cricket over the history of the time, are all reported back having this mindset that could be deemed as having an intention to score first. So whilst the game's moved on, in particular 2020 has moved on since that research was done, I think the mindsets are similar. They're just reapplied into each different format.
And the situation makes a difference as well to what you're looking to do. You know, if you're opening the batting in a 4-day game, you know, first innings, you're going to have a different approach if you've got to go at sixes or eights or tens in a 20 or a 50 over match. So, but that phrase intent, it covers everything then, doesn't it? From the longest format to the last ball of a 20 over game, where you need six to win. If you look into intent, bat with intent within whatever the particular scenario is, then you can't go too far wrong.
It's true, and I remember Strousey making his debut back in 2004 against New Zealand at Lord's, where he got 100, and then NASA ran him out to stop him from having to buy a big jug for everybody in the second innings. And also NASA wanted to hit the winning runs in his last test, so I can understand that from his point of view. But I remember Strousey being eight not out or nine not out off about five balls. And whilst, you know, most people would have gone into their first test match, home ground, been working their socks off to get this opportunity and would have been looking to, you know, just play and bat for 20 minutes and see how he was, because he didn't know what was going to happen. He got two balls that he could score off, which he would score off any day of the week, and he put them away, and all of a sudden he was flying, you know, and what a great start to his test career. And that's not from somebody that we're known for being incredibly aggressive, I suppose, as a batter. He was still able to do that. So having an intention to score, I think, is absolutely crucial. And it's certainly language that I use a lot when I coach.
And that's interesting that ties in really to your mindset as a player in terms of the overall situation. You know, if you're letting external influences get to you, then you will play differently. But if you are looking to say to yourself, well, if I get a ball I can hit for four, I'm going to hit it for four, regardless of what's going on in the rest of the world, then that's a really powerful mindset to be in.
It is, and often some of the best rear guard defensive efforts in Test cricket have been littered with some really good shots. So I think back to people playing in India where there's four men around the bat and all of that sort of malarkey, and obviously they're all waiting there for a good bit of bowling or a poor defensive execution. But some of the best innings I've seen in that context, if a ball's gone into an area which on that pitch at that given time can go, it still goes. And then that puts the bowler under pressure. It makes the close fielders think a little bit differently about how they're going to position themselves and all of that. And it just keeps the energy flowing through the body as well and through the mind, which is so crucial. So it's a really good thing to have. And obviously then you need to bring game context in, and a half volley on a pitch, first day pitch of a test match from an off spinner might be different to playing it out of a 5-day old foot mark. But you know, if they do miss those areas and it does come into yours, then you should put it away irrespective.
Soapbox time now on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, and that means 60 seconds on the clock. It means Sam Lavery on the soapbox, and he can talk about anything he likes. Lavers, over to you.
One of the things that's come up in discussion a bit lately is trying to find some cricket mats. We haven't been able to find any for a while, and the new ones, the old ones we've got, need replacing at school, and the old style are no longer in production, so you can't get them anymore, and finding something that's really good is going to be quite difficult. And I just wanted to report that we found some, really. So there is a new type of cricket mat out there. It is a little bit slower and lower than the average mat, which I think is a good thing for most people who have experienced indoor training. So it is a little bit slower and lower. It was brought over to the Aegeus Bowl, and myself and Tony Middleton were kind of watching it being used the other day, and Tony threw one ball on it and said, "I'll take one," which was good. He said, "How much was it?" And they're called Chematech, and I don't really know how much they're going to do, but they're supplying a few counties already, and I think they're going to start spilling them out a little bit further. So there is an opportunity for a new mat out there, and you can get hold of it if you want to.
And that is the end of the show for another week. Before we go, there's just a couple of things we need to sort out. The first of those is the winner of this week's prize, the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy, pitchvision.com. And the two questions available for it this week are Rishav's one about playing Yorkers and Monish's one about playing defensively or aggressively. So which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I'm going to go with Monish's one. I think it's really topical, and I like the question, actually. Hopefully we've given you a couple of ideas there, buddy.
Congratulations to you. And Gareth, if someone was listening into the show and they wanted their question answered and they also wanted to win the prize of the online coaching course, how could they send their questions in to us?
They could give us a call, David, on 0203 239 7543, or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right. You can also find us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. And you can tweet us if you so desire. At PitchVisionAcad is our handle over there. If you want to listen to the show every week, you can do so by subscribing for free. Go to your favourite podcast app, do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, and you'll find us there. Just tap on the subscribe button. And if you want to download the show to your computer or get the show notes or stream it live via the website, then you can do that by going to pitchvision.com/academy and clicking on the podcast link. You get all the details for all the shows going back to the beginning. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, guys.